addiction. It's called the most formidable health problem in the world. One in five over the age of 14 is addicted to something. And whether you're a victim yourself or you know somebody, a family member or a friend who is, it's a topic that has a lot of moving pieces. And the part that I'm going to talk about tonight is how the brain of addicts might be different than the average brain, and how we might overcome addiction based on what we know about it. Dr. Grizel is a PhD behavioral neuroscientist with expertise in pharmacology and genetics, whose research focuses on determining the root causes of drug addiction. She is the author of a really fine book called Never Enough. Welcome to the show, Dr. Judy. Hi, how are you?
Hi, Karen. I'm fine. Thanks for having me.
Very nice to have you. I read the book very, very quickly this week, and it was a great book because it gives you a lot of detail about the brain without it, but it's readable, which is very good because it's very complicated. It's brain surgery, if you will.
It is complicated, and that was my goal, actually. I thought after failing to solve it with my own research and about 25 years of working on the problem, I thought, well, the least I can do is try to explain what we do understand in a way that everybody can understand it. I think so often the scientists are off at their lab benches working on really important problems, and then people are wondering basic questions, but there's not much of a bridge sometimes between the two. So my goal is to make a bridge, or a part of it anyway.
And you did a good job. And one interesting, fascinating fact is that you yourself were a serious addict. Can you tell our listeners briefly, and the point of this is you bring this into the book and you kind of juxtapose your own personal experiences with the stuff that you know now about how the brain works and how the brain gets people addicted and keeps people addicted. Tell us a little bit about some of the issues you had.
Well, by the time I was 23, I had just turned 23, actually, and I had been using about 10 years. I first started with alcohol and then marijuana and then stimulants and basically everything I could get my hands on. So for 10 years, I used as much and as often as I could until by the time I was 22, I had been homeless and kicked out of three schools and pretty hopeless and lost. And when I ended up in treatment, kind of by mistake, I thought I was actually going to a spa. This was in the 1980s, so it wasn't so widely understood, I guess. So I didn't know what I was doing, but I ended up in treatment with nurses and not pedicures for sure. I learned that I had maybe a disease of the brain and that, I was going to destroy myself if I kept using. And I thought, with kind of understandable determination, if you're somebody like me, you know that, you know, try to take away my drugs. I thought, there's no way I can live without these chemicals because this is all there's worth living for anyway. So I thought, well, I'll solve addiction, which is really hilarious to me now because I was so arrogant and naive, but I somehow, by force of will, I guess, managed to finish my undergraduate, which took 7 years in total, and then I went to graduate school for another 7 years, and then I did a 3-year postdoc, and anyway, all of that was focused on understanding the mechanisms of addiction. So what I really wanted to know, and I still want to know, is what's different about the brains of people like me before we ever pick up a drug, and then during the time we're using, and maybe even afterward, that make us respond so differently. And I thought if I could understand what's different about the brain, then I could fix it. So we do understand quite a lot about what's different, and that was the purpose of the book. We haven't been able to fix it yet, but we'll see how that goes.
You're listening to Dr. Judy Grizel, who is the author of Never Enough, about how the brain affects addiction and those issues. Again, you know, these are very complicated issues, and I'm not sure we can explain all of them on the radio. You'd have to read the book to really get a good understanding. But there's a thought that I always had, which is that people who are depressed and people who are anxious use drugs and alcohol as sort of a self-medication, and that's how the addiction comes into play. But having read your book, that's really not the issue at all, is it?
Well, I don't know, Karen. I would say for some people, so let me back up. There's many reasons, and there may be as many reasons to become an addict as there are addicts or alcoholics. I think it is complicated. The head of the National Institute of Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism is George Kube, and he says a funny thing about this. He says, you can either be born an alcoholic or drink a lot and become one. So I think there are people, and I was probably one of these, who have a genetic predisposition. They're kind of prone that way. The way we respond to drugs from the very first time we try them is maybe different from other people who are less prone. And sometimes that proneness might take the form of depression or anxiety. So for sure, anxiety is a predictor of alcohol use disorders, but for reasons that I explain in the book, using alcohol a lot also makes you more anxious, so it's kind of a vicious circle. And I think there is some evidence that depression and anxiety and addiction are kind of three sides of the same coin. However, anybody can become an addict if they use enough of any substance. So I think there are many reasons and many pathways. Part of those are biological, part of those are environmental.
A lot of what you talk about, Dr. Whelan, we have a few minutes before we take a break here, but is the adaption that the brain, the adaptive qualities of the brain, so that your brain is always adapting to what you're giving it and what you're exposing it to. And that has a lot to do with addiction, if I can really simplify it. And there was one example that I thought was fascinating. And you say, if the same person goes to a bar every Friday for 10 years and they know they're going to have their three drinks or whatever it is, it's almost like they become accustomed to it, and their brain sets itself up to do what it likes to do, and your brain knows it's going to happen. Then one time, after 10 years, you go instead to a party rather than a bar. There's an idea that if you go to the bar, you might become more intoxicated with the exact same amount of alcohol because your brain is not going into its same adaptive mode that it went into with the routine that you had. I'm probably muddling this a little bit.
No, I think you meant if you go to the party instead of the bar,
right?
You'll
that's right.
get more drunk.
Yes.
Right.
So
yeah,
why would
exactly
that be?
Right.
You're drinking the same amount, you're drinking, you're doing the same thing at the same time, but you're in a different place. Why would your body react differently?
Well, probably the brain's most wonderful attribute is its ability to adapt. And it adapts to all drugs, especially abuse drugs, by producing the exact opposite effects that the drug produces. So, like if you're drinking at the bar, the drug alcohol makes you relaxed and a little euphoric. You'll tend to feel tense and maybe dysphoric before you drink, if you're anticipating it. And because it adapts so well, it uses the environmental cues to predict, oh, she's going to have her three gin and tonics now, so I'm going to get ready by being kind of tense and anxious, so that when I get those gin and tonics, I feel just pretty good. But if I wasn't expecting it, because the brain doesn't know, you know, we're in a different context, maybe it would have a bigger effect. So the bottom line, the core principle that you're talking about is that any drug you take regularly, the brain produces the opposite effect of. And for that reason, you're tolerant and dependent and craving. And in this case, that drinking at a party might make you so much more intoxicated with the same amount that you'd be, you know, less able to drive, less able to control your emotions or have reasonable thoughts, those kinds of things.
Very interesting. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking some more with Dr. Judy Grizzell, the author of a great book, which is Never Enough. We'll be back in a minute. Welcome back. We're talking about addiction with Dr. Judy Grizzell, author of Never Enough. Welcome back to the show, Dr. Grizzell.
Thanks.
So let's talk a little bit about ranking the addict qualities of different drugs. How would you rate them as far as what are the ones that are most addictive?
Well, so addiction is probably five main criteria, tolerance and dependence and craving that we've talked about. Also, it has to be harmful, so it hurts the user and usually, or maybe always, people around them and society in general. And finally, there's denial of the problem. So mostly we focused on the first three, or the first four, I guess, in saying what's most addictive. Certainly, the habit forming dependence, where you, if you take away the drug, you have withdrawal, is most quickly developed to nicotine. So cigarettes are wildly addictive. In early studies, before we had, you know, advertising and it was clear that they were bad for your health, I think there was a study where anybody, you know, something like 96% of people who smoked seven cigarettes in their life developed a habit.
Wow.
So, you know, nothing is really that addictive. It's a really compelling drug. I think in terms of harm, also nicotine is at the top of the list, closely followed by alcohol. So it's interesting that the two legal drugs are
the
most harmful.
Right. I think you said in your book that nicotine takes away 15 years of a person's life.
Yeah,
that's
no,
amazing.
It's really, it's tragic. But I think opiates are certainly very addictive. So if you, it's very you know, the first time you use opiates, your brain begins adapting, and it makes it more and more likely that you're going to crave opiates again. And so you can really fall into a habit so quickly with opiates, more quickly than with alcohol, although I think alcohol's caused more damage by far overall, and it still is the case, you know, each year in the U.S. that alcohol's cost more lives and health and all of that. Cocaine and the stimulants are also very, very addictive. So they are drugs that everybody likes, and so anybody could develop a habit to those, and it's more likely in a way. And nicotine is a stimulant as well. So that general class of drugs is addictive. I think, you know, all of the drugs we're talking about are drugs that produce pleasure, so we like the way they feel, and anything that gives us that feeling of pleasure can be addictive.
Is it true, though, that at some point it's not so much the pleasure that you're seeking, but when you're an addict, is that you just want to feel normal because your overindulgence of these thing in these things make you feel agitated, as you said, irritable maybe, and you, that's why you need that fix in order not to feel pleasure anymore, but to not feel bad.
Oh, that's absolutely right, Karen. So you, the first time you use, it's sort of a nice little luxury, you know, like a special treat. And that luxury, if you do it regularly, becomes a habit. And then there's less pleasure, and it's more habitual. And then habits become compulsions, as you pointed out, we're using not so much to feel the good feelings, but to avoid feeling the bad feelings we feel when the drug is not there. And that's dependence. So taking away the drug, you feel less than good. So you're using just to feel okay. And opiate addicts, for instance, almost never get high. They're only avoiding feeling sick. And then once you have a compulsion, you know, really have an addiction because, so what started out as sort of a nice little treat, now it, just to feel normal and just to feel okay and just to get through the day, you need the drug. So you're not really benefiting in so much as you're just avoiding misery.
Interesting. Can we take a call? Is that okay, Dr. Grizel?
Sure, okay. That'd be great.
Hi, John. You're calling from Gurnee. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. Good. I think we lost Judy. Ben. Anyway.
Oh,
okay.
Sorry about that.
Okay. We'll get her back on in 1 minute here. Go ahead and tell us what your issue is.
It's basically it's this. It's like I run a company and I'm work every day. You know, pretty hard, and I'm available to my company day and night. But then what happens is that there'll be certain nights when I drink way too much in excess, and I'm wondering why that happens certain times. It's like, I know why it happens, but it's like, it just, I'm wondering. So,
okay. So I'm sorry. You're saying you're not planning on having a drink, but then, then you all of a sudden,
no, then I have one, then two, then.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you hear any of that?
I heard the last part. I think I got the idea. So the first part is what causes us to pick up when we intend not to. And really, there's three main reasons. One of them is stress, which is prevalent. So that's one reason it's so hard to stay clean. Another one are the environmental cues that we were just talking about, Karen. So going to the bar, if you decide to go to that bar that you usually drink in but don't want to have a drink, once you get in there, you really feel like having them. So seeing your friends who are drinking, smelling the smoke, whatever it is. And then the third thing, which I think the caller is talking about, is the taste of the drug. So it's easy. I was very much this way. I can remember saying, well, you know, I'm not going to drink today. And then I would have, smoke a little weed or just have one beer, I thought. And the next thing I know, I was kind of off to the races. So I think that once you taste the drug, especially if you are kind of on your way to having a habit, it's really hard. It sort of sets up the craving. So I'm the same way. I haven't had a drink in a long time because I think once I get a little bit in my system, I think all bets would be off.
That's right. We only have a few minutes for this fascinating topic, but I want to talk about just, you know, moving forward here. For children, smoking marijuana can be dangerous to children. I'm going to bullet point some of these as quickly as I can. Is that fair to say that you shouldn't let your kids smoke marijuana? If they are, you should be of concern.
Well, good luck not letting your kids smoke marijuana.
Right.
I don't
exactly.
mean to be cynical there, but I think, you know, I don't think there's much chance of that. And I think kids, to be fair, pick up on what we do more than what we say. So if we're drinking, for instance, we're enjoying our drug, and we tell them, but don't you enjoy your drug? I mean, they look at the effects of alcohol that they see around them, and they're not so into that. They're not so into nicotine either. They see that as a problem. But they are smoking a lot of weed, and it's true. You know, if you could stop them, good luck. I think that it would be helpful because while their brain is developing, it's particularly vulnerable to the impacts of any drug, including marijuana. We have clear evidence that marijuana alters the trajectory of brain development, and that affects your behaviors for a lifetime. So you would be more prone to using other drugs of abuse and using them at higher doses, for one thing, which would set you up for subsequent addictions, but also maybe anxious and have a depressive mood state. So there's a lot of evidence that if you could wait until your brain is finished developing, which is about age 25, but even 24 is better than 23, and 23 is better than 22, so as long as possible, to let the brain kind of get the circuits settled, then the drug would have less deleterious effects.
And of course, when you're that age, maybe you have better decision-making skills and you may decide not to do those things in the first place.
Yeah,
which is
work for me.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it's a tall order. I think education is helpful, and I think kids would be maybe like to know about what the effects are long term.
Yeah,
hopefully we'll have the research for that.
I think that's a good thing. Just we only have a few minutes here. Again, I hear people all the time. Well, just stop taking the drug. Well, just stop eating so much. Just stop doing this. You know, like there. You know, this is a disease that we're talking about, but there are people like you who were in the midst of a horrible bunch of addictions. You just didn't have one. You had a bunch of them going on. And it turns out, you know, you're a brilliant woman. You went and you got all this great education and you've cured yourself, or at least you're a recovering addict. And the idea is that who are the people that overcome and who are the people that don't? Are there certain qualities that you see, not maybe necessarily in the brain here, because we probably don't know the answer to that, but are there certain people? Is it a support system? Is it some kind of internal motivation? What is it that turns people around and keeps people off of the drugs?
Well, I don't think I was cured, because if I was cured, I would be able to use normally, and I don't think that I would be able to. Yeah, no, that's okay. I just wanted to be clear. I don't know the answer to that. It's a really important question. One of the interesting things about this disease is that the worse off you are when you're sort of diagnosed, the better your chances, which is kind of upside down from other diseases where maybe the smaller the tumor is, the better you are off. So I don't think that we know what are the factors. But for me, it involved telling the truth about myself to myself, you know, and looking at my life honestly, which is really hard to do because we talked about denial being one of the core symptoms. And then I had to be willing to change, which I was provisionally willing, we could say. I explained that a little bit in the book. And then I used a lot of help. So I've also been really fortunate to have, you know, support around me. My family was supportive, and I had, you know, counseling and treatment and a halfway house. So I think it was a kind of a community effort in my case.
And we have literally 30 seconds. People who are with loved ones who have addiction, tough love. You show them love, acceptance, kindness. What's the give me just a real bullet point.
I think addicts have to be held responsible for their actions. I don't think they should be to blame. So I think tough love is better than enabling. My parents kicked me out of the house actually when they realized that my drug use wasn't going to stop. And I think that helped me realize the truth about myself more quickly. So but they were also loving. So I think it's a fine line. It's not easy.
That's Dr. Judy Grizzell, thank you so much for joining us. Her book is Never Enough. It's available on Amazon. And is there a website that you can give quickly for us?
Yes. You can look up Judy Grizzell at Bucknell University and find my website.
Thank you so much.
Or you can write to me at neverenoughdrugs@gmail.com.
Thank you so much for joining us. Coming up, the stories
Thank
that
you.
Matter with Roger Badish from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN.